My favorite question is asking the candidate what questions they have for me. And
100%. And when they say they don't have one, I bet that's a red flag, right?
More than 50% of the candidates say, I think you could. I say, after I'm kind of all done, I say, I want to give time for you to ask me any questions, something we may not have covered. More than 50% of candidates say, I think you covered everything. And that's like so lame.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. This is the show where we learn from executives and founders what they see differently when it comes to identifying top talent. If this is your first episode, welcome. I appreciate you being here. To our longtime listeners, thank you for your support. Please subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps the show. Today, we have a really special guest, somebody I am so excited to dig into it with. Ira Burns, he is the EVP and Chief Financial Officer at World Connect, otherwise known as World Fuel. How are you doing, Ira?
Doing great. Great to be here, Oz. Thanks for having me.
It's a little bit chilly out here in South Florida. This is one of the colder days so far of our winter.
I feel
bad saying that because our friends in New York, I got like 22 degrees, but how are you dealing with the cold? All good?
I slept with my New York Yankee fleece jacket last night, so I'm surviving somehow.
Oh, that's Florida for it's real cold. So, and we are going to get to those Yankees. I want to talk to you about that a little bit towards the end. Let's start here, though. I moved to South Florida in 2005. A company that was rocket shipping up at the time was World Fuel, growing, big organization. I'm interested. Can you tell us a little bit about the organization, World Fuel, and now World Connect, and why you decided to join the company?
So it's funny to start. You said you came in 2005 and it was growing like crazy, which is true. I showed up in 2007 and I think I found a way to reverse that trend. Well, maybe we'll talk more about that later. I lived in New York my whole life. I was actually in the technology industry for almost 20 years. And I was a New York snob, right? I knew a lot of people that would find a job out of New York, decide to move away, and I would, maybe I shouldn't use the word, but I would just tell them they were losers, right? How could you leave New York?
Can't hack it.
And whenever I would get a call, I would just, probably be somewhat obnoxious. I remember getting a call about the opportunity in Minneapolis and St. Louis and Kansas City. And then one day I was heading down to South Florida for the holidays to visit my folks who used to spend their winters down here. And I got a call from Spencer Stewart, one of the big recruiting firms, saying, "We know you always blow us off, but what about Miami?" And I said, "Well, I'm going there tomorrow." So I actually had my interviews like Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve or New Year's Day at the Biltmore in Coral Gables, knowing nothing about World Fuel, that's what it was called at the time, or the fuel industry, and somehow got the job, which is what moved me down here. I was intrigued by the interesting similarities between my role in my previous life and the role that I've had for the last couple decades in terms of just similar challenges despite different commodities, different industries. I came from the largest middleman, lack of a sexier term, in the technology business, and went to the largest middleman in the energy business. Right, so that middleman role has a lot of a lot of similarities. So it's worked fairly well, but that rocket ship has slowed down a little bit. World has changed. There was a time I used to be able to brag at a bar that we had a higher 10-year average return on our stock than Apple did. We'd be in the top 10 and we'd be ahead of Apple. We used to use that slide in all of our marketing materials. We've done fairly well, but that pace was impossible to continue as we got larger and larger and larger, probably an excuse more than anything. But we're still holding our own, doing pretty well.
Yeah, I love that. And listen, when I came into this area in South Florida, I started my career in technology as well. I was working at a Fortune 500, but I got into recruitment and HR consulting pretty quickly. And World Fuel was a company that we had worked with. And correct me if I'm wrong here, this better than anybody, really large volume company, right? Like lower profitability margins, but you're doing it at such a scale and such high volume that the organization was just like growing. And I know we started doing work like in the energy trade risk management space. And so as I start to learn about kind of how you diversified and how you did different things, air, land, and really started, the company started to grow, it was really looked at as like a shining light in South Florida in terms of, you know, having a great concept and pushing it forward and becoming like what you were saying, the growth of the likes of only Apple, right, could talk about. So I want to ask you one thing real quickly here, though, because it's interesting. I was here in South Florida. Then we opened up an office. We started working with like some of the biggest banks in the world, fortunately, like Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan. And we started doing a lot of business in New York where they had a lot of their technology. And for me, especially at the time, and South Florida was just a very different market, just the way we go about our work out here and the amount of Fortune 500 companies, obviously, versus New York, where I got to be honest, when I got up there, I felt like some simpatico. I'm like, oh, okay, people want to get shit done here. They want to move fast. They want to be aggressive. Like for me, it felt really, really good. And I felt like, you know, we were paying Florida bills and making New York money until we opened up our office there. And then we started to really build our presence. I'm so interested about the transition here, because there's a lot of people have done it. You're not the first person to go from New York to Florida, obviously. But as a professional, like, what was the adjustment like? Was there any like was your style a little bit too much initially when you came on? Did you have to adjust that, or did you find a lot of like-minded people when you first came down here?
Yeah, you know, when I came down in 2007, Miami, South Florida was not what it is today. So it's easier, right? More people are doing it now, especially post-COVID for lots of reasons. Maybe we'll get into that later. Back then, I probably had the guts to make the move more because it was a second home to me, right? My aunt, my father's sister lived here for many years. I came down, probably came down to Florida every year of my life from the age of 12. So 30 some odd years before I got the job, I had already, you know, been down here. So I knew the streets, I knew the restaurants. But it had just come off the back of two of the ugliest hurricane seasons in the Miami area. Obviously, they've now moved west over the last several years. And when I came down for interviews, every house had a blue tarp on it. Brickell, where I lived for many years, had like, you know, two restaurants, you know, Capital Grill and Rosa Americana. I mean, there was nothing else there. So I was comforted by the move more because of the family piece of the puzzle at the time than the glamour of Miami, if you will. A lot of the people that I wound up working with were like me. They had just moved here maybe before I did, right? So I wound up working for a New Yorker from Brooklyn and another guy who spent many years in New York that was originally from Texas. So I would say it was pretty easy. I do remember, I still drive by this gigantic warehouse building somewhere between my office and the airport. And I slow down when I pass it by because I remember driving to work on my first day and like pulling off the road and shaking, saying, what have I done? Because, you know, I had a good job and I liked it. And I'm like, what's going to happen when I walk into this building when I get? So I try to delay my first day walking into the new life by 5 minutes by pulling my car off on the side of the road, right? So I think about it every time I pass that building. But it quickly became, you know, arguably very similar, you know, similar people again, a lot of people from the Northeast. Adapting to living here was actually kind of easy, right? Because I don't like cold weather.
It's a lot of light.
I moved here kind of sort of tail end of the winter. Where it was beautiful here in March and it was, you know, snowing in New York. I commuted for quite a while, kept my home in New York, and then after a while kind of got tired of doing that and didn't feel the need to keep going back. So I finally kind of grew up and, you know, gave up on kind of splitting my time. So it was a pretty easy
transition
adjustment for me. Then, of course, over the last 15, 17, 18 years, it's become an even cooler place to live, right? Yeah. There's so many things to do, so much going on. You know, airport's gotten a lot better. I travel a lot. It's easy to get anywhere. Food is equal to, I like food and wine, right? Equal to New York, if not better, to some extent. You know, a lot of interesting people. You know, New York, I lived on Long Island. I didn't live in Manhattan. So, you know, everyone was either, you know, Jewish or Italian, right? And everyone was from Long Island. Maybe if you were lucky, they were from Queens, right? You know, here you're working with people from all over the world.
It's one of the most international cities we have in the country.
Absolutely. Europeans, Latin, South Americans, et cetera. So it's, you know, it's been, my kids at the time were younger. They felt the same thing. They came and went. My older son was going to high school. My younger son was going to middle school. We moved and they were just used to the Long Island crowd, right? And now they had classmates from everywhere speaking different languages. And so I think it was a great experience for them ultimately. And they, you know, they had, you know, an enjoyable young adult life here as well.
Yeah. Quick aside there, real. When I moved here, it sounds like we were right on around the same time, because what people don't really remember is that Katrina came through us, but it wasn't very bad before it went up to New Orleans, unfortunately, right? But right before that, I believe, was Wilma, which did hit this market pretty. And I had been here maybe a month and I was staying with some family and they're like, yup, a hurricane's coming. I was in Pembroke Pines and they came and I was sleeping upstairs and they knocked on the door like, hey, a hurricane's here. You're going to want to come downstairs in case the roof comes off. And I'm like, what? And so then we go, the hurricane passes us by. They get in a car and go to Orlando and leave me there. And it's like a war zone here. And it's funny because, as I'll tell you, the time of the year, it was, I blogged on MySpace about, I just came here from Arizona. There's no natural disasters. I'm here. I'm at, there's the gas station is out of gas. People are fighting over food in the supermarket. Like, what did I do? So I had kind of that similar kind of moment, right, of reflection. It's just so funny. And then to your point, now we have everything here. There's so many different things that have come down. It almost feels like we got in early on something that has really, really started to grow and become this really metropolitan place.
And knock on wood, I feel terrible for what's happened to people that live in the west coast of Florida. But we haven't been the entire 18 years, almost 18 years I lived here, we haven't had a single impact.
I'll only allow you to say that outside of hurricane zone time, because anytime it comes up, I am knocking on wood every time, because it's just a matter of when, right?
That's right. That's right.
So let's talk about, I want to talk a little bit about like your career journey, because that's always super fascinating to me. Was finance something you were always going to be in? Were you like the type of person that was like doing the accounting for your lemonade stand, or like, tell me about your journey into finance.
No, I wanted to be in sales. I think I may have told you the story when I first met you. I was going to college. My parents helped fund college, even though I started working, to speaking about sales. I had a job when I was 12. I think I lied about my age to get a job because I was selling beer and cigarettes and things like that in a store. But there was no way my mother was going to let me go to college and not major in something that would be rewarding. And I wasn't going to be a doctor. Thought about the law profession for a while. So I settled on accounting. But even through school, I honestly hated it. Every job that I had during school was sales related. One of my favorite little stories is during a Christmas break, I worked at the Chanel counter in Macy's, which was a cool experience because they do more sales in that 2-week period than they do like the entire year. So it was just a, you know, crazy experience. People coming and spending a lot of money on perfume and stuff. When I graduated college, the first jobs I was looking for were sales related. And I don't know if this is a completely true story, but it's so many years ago, but I think it's reasonably true that my mother found out I went on an interview. I don't know if it was Xerox or Ricoh, one of the copier companies, to be in sales. And she told them not to hire me. So I wound up again succumbing to my mom. We may talk about her again later too. And enter the accounting profession. I got a job as an auditor. The only reason I took that job was A, because my mother forced me to go down that path, and B, it was cool because it involved a tremendous amount of travel. So I said, if I'm going to get into that profession, at least I could hit the road and see the country on someone else's dime. So I got a job as an auditor for an interesting conglomerate, did a lot of travel, earned my CPA that way. So I am a CPA. It's not the thing I'm most proud of based on the story that I just told you. But I've always been a closet sales guy. When I go into meeting with the sales guys, I want to do their job. They don't want to do my job. I want to do their job. I had a business, I'm going backwards, when I was in high school, I started Ira's Coins. This is before the internet, so it's not like I had a website. So you would type up your price list and send it out in the mail, and had a post office box at the local post office. And I had my business card, sold t-shirts in my high school. And I would, you know, sell coins to people, you know, rare coins. I still have a lot of them that's sitting in a box that I don't know what I'll ever do with. You know, it's always been a my kind of closet profession, thinking up, I'm going to start my own website and, you know, make a lot of money on it. Maybe I'll do that in my 70s. But, you know, that first job kind of led me into the corporate world. I very quickly try to tell the story without going on too long. I was an auditor for a while. And then one of the audits that I did a few times was the Treasury Group, right? For those that aren't familiar, right, that's the group that manages the company's banking relationships and cash flows in and out the door and insurance and things like that. And it was a fun audit because the guys that ran that group were so bad that as an auditor, you know, if you're an auditor and you go and everything's perfect, it looks like you're not doing any work, right? And they were so bad that I was able to write this like scathing report every time of all the things that were at risk and wrong. And then I'd go back and do it again, and they didn't fix anything that they were supposed to fix based on the last report. And one day my boss called me in on a Saturday. So I lived on Long Island. I took the train to New York City where this company was. And he said, I'm relieving you of your duties. So I thought I was getting fired. And he said, I'm not firing you, but as of Monday, you're in the Treasury Department because you're the only one that understands how to fix that thing. And those guys aren't responding to anything that you've recommended. I was maybe 25 at the time, and this was a public, you know, New York Stock Exchange company. Within 6 months, the two guys that ran that group were gone. Some interesting stories there too. And I took over, and I was 25 years old, and I was an officer of the company and managing all the banking relationship and all that. And that got me into a long career of that type of work, right, treasury-related activity. From there, I moved on to a company called Arrow Electronics that used to be based on Long Island. It's now based in Denver. That's now an $8 billion market cap company. Started there as treasurer at a very young age as well, 27 maybe, and took on a lot of responsibility over 17 years, including M&A, which is now still my favorite thing, right? That company grew by acquisition, and you know, I led a lot of the acquisition activity for, you know, for many, many years, investor relations, you know, you name it. It got to the point where I wanted to be a CFO, and my buddy that I worked with for 15 years was blocking me. He always told me he was going to retire, but you know, he just retired recently, so good thing I didn't wait for him. So I started looking around, which dovetails with the earliest story about not wanting to go to St. Louis or Minneapolis until this opportunity showed up. And I wanted it really bad. But then when I got the job, the reason I pulled over on the side of the road was I didn't really think I was qualified. I felt that I bullshitted my way through the interview process, and I knew how to be a CFO. And I realized pulling in that first day that I'd never done this before. What am I going to do when they ask me something and I don't have the answer, right? And somehow magically that never was a problem. And I've told other people this as my career has gone on that have made that leap, including a guy that worked for me, moved on a couple of years ago, you know, David Hecht. He was afraid the same way. And I said, you're going to figure it out. Trust me. And he's doing a great job.
I think the idea of imposter syndrome is a bit of a fallacy because by definition, anytime you take on a bigger role or you go into a new company, you are never 100% prepared or 100% ready for everything that's going to come up. It comes down to your adaptability, your learning agility, your desire to keep growing and things like that.
So even if you know that, Oz, your mind doesn't necessarily tell you that rationally.
You still
have the imposter syndrome in your heart, if you will, until you show up and realize – even when I took that job many, many moons ago in the technology business, I felt the same way. I almost like threw up on the way to work on the first day, right? So I'm sure a lot of people go through that unnecessarily, but it's just maybe a rite of passage to some extent.
Pain, failure, stress is part of the crucible of growth, right? There's never a like linear like growth path where you don't, you know, I was just listening to a podcast on a founder of Dropbox, and he was talking about the different phases of that company and how he was on the top of the world. And then he had he was getting Google Photos came out and all these different things happened and how they've had to pivot the company. And there's zero level of people that have had ultimate success that haven't been wandering the desert or wondering, am I the right person to do this? Or I have to get up to speed sooner than later, right? So I think it's part of it. There's a couple of things you said that really stand out to me. One, I got to laugh about your mom, and we are going to talk about her in a minute. Because I, you know, recently there was these reports of kids bringing their parents to the interview. Your mom's calling ahead and telling him not to give him the job. So I find that to be fantastic. Yeah. Another thing I really kind of like honed in on, because I'm obsessed with interviewing, and we're going to talk about that in a minute too, is this question of, tell me your first job and how early it was. Because one, I read this a long time ago, it's no longer the case, but a lot of the most famous entrepreneurs like Warren Buffett and people like that were paper boys, right, growing up. And they were doing that at a really young age. And I find that the people that were like, and I too had a job at 12, 13 years old, because I just wanted to get in the workforce and start going. I think that's such a great indicator of somebody that maybe lacks entitlement, that knew at an early age they wanted to get going and kind of, you know, work was going to be part of their identity. So that's just something that's a little bit of been an unlock for me that I'm certainly going to start adding to my interview practices.
Yeah, I was a paper boy at 11 or 12 years old too.
Now the people today, they hear a paper boy and they're like, what are you talking? What's a newspaper first off? But it sounds like that's one of the first entrepreneurial journeys you can take, is that you got your own little route and you're throwing newspapers at people's houses and you get paid. And there's a Steve Jobs, I think, was too. There's a ton of really successful people that started their career in that space.
I had between the ages of 12 and college graduation day, I must've had 15 different jobs. Completely different. I worked in a gas station. I worked in a department store in the camera department in a store called Abraham and Strauss that doesn't exist anymore. You know, I did a little bit of everything because I figured this is the time I could try stuff, and it doesn't work out. Right?
I worked at a shaved ice place, a bagel place, Ross Dress for Less, a hat store. I was a referee for the YMCA. I was hustling like you were, and I was selling candy bars and blow pops at school. So
The other thing about the paperboy experience, which is interesting, you know, glass half empty, glass half full, maybe. Amazingly, after all these years, which is probably like 50 years, I still remember the cheap person that didn't tip me. I remember their apartment number and their name. Little do people know, by not being generous, the long-term impact of the perception of you. I used to see this lady in the supermarket, and I always hated her. It was 90 cents back then to get a 7-day subscription to the Long Island Press. And she would give me a dollar and put out her hand for the 10 cents back. At the same time, I grew up in a town where the Rangers, the New York Rangers, and the New York Jets all lived, because the Rangers training facility was in this Long Island back then.
Okay.
And the Jets used to practice at Hofstra, which was only 15, 20 minutes away, which is where I went to college. Those guys, 90 cents, because some of them would get the paper, $5. Back then, $5 was like $500 today.
Life-changing money.
So I still remember, it's amazing the things that you remember on the generous side.
The correlation between a long memory and keeping a chip on your shoulders, also people of success. I want to dive a little bit into Hofstra. So famously alumni, Wayne Krabet, great receiver for the Jets. Let's talk a little bit about the current role, because I'm so fascinated by the way you go about your leadership. So you've told me one of your core leadership philosophies around getting alignment on your team, which I know is not easy and very difficult. And you're doing that with a company that, five people growing to 250 plus, I can imagine what it's like at the scale of a World Fuel. So why is that important? And what happens in large organizations that becomes such a problem?
Alignment, you're saying.
Because we assume we have it as leaders, right?
Yeah. How do you boil a really long answer into a short one? Look, at the end of the day, every company has goals and objectives, or they should. Every company needs to find their own rhythm in working towards achieving those goals and objectives. And as a public company, what's the number one goal? Driving shareholder value. I mean, you want to keep your people happy, but you're here to keep your investors happy as well, right? Everyone inherently, in my mind, and I've seen it for many, many years, probably has either a slightly or dramatically different view on how to get from point A to point B. In some companies, it's maybe not the right words, free range, right? So it's chaos because everyone wants to get to the same place. They want to get there in a different way. They prioritize differently, and then nothing gets done. It's probably one of the most common problems in corporate America. That's where the alignment piece comes in, right? Because in order to effectively achieve those goals, which we don't always get to ourselves. Everyone has to be locked in on priorities. So being aligned, you have to attach the word alignment to priorities to make it maybe more meaningful, to being aligned around what priorities, and you know, we call, you know, we use the term rank stacking, all sorts of crazy terms, but, you know, what are the first three things that we all agree we have to get done before we go to number four? Because there's always someone in the room that just, maybe that's their sweet spot. So they want to focus on number four, but it doesn't make sense to do that first, right? So it isn't easy because everyone leaves a room. And, you know, if you don't communicate, that's the other key word, right? If you don't communicate often and well enough, chaos comes back, right? You know, I work with my team really care. We have goal. We know what we want to achieve. Everyone contributes a different piece to that puzzle to get there, whether it's cash flow, whether it's driving improved operating margins, whether it's driving, you know, driving growth, whether it's, you know, M&A opportunities and things like that. But they all have to fit together well, and everyone has to be aligned around, yeah, we all agree that those are the things that we're focusing on. No pocket vetoes. I hate that term, but, it's not always that easy to get there, right? You have to have the right people. You have to communicate with them the right way. You got to keep them motivated. You have to have goals and objectives that they believe in, because if you want to get everyone aligned around a stupid goal or an impossible goal, yeah, it's going to make alignment a lot more difficult, right? Sure. So that's probably an art more than a science. But it's critically important, because I've seen it go wrong over and over and over again in my career where, folks just don't see the solutions the same way. And they're working hard. They're doing what they think is right. But then you have all these different silos doing things to get somewhere, and they're not connected. And therefore, you wind up not getting there. Right. And that's a common problem.
So fantastic insight. That was like 3 to 4 minutes of just like wealth of knowledge for people and leaders who struggle with that alignment. I know I was taking some notes. There are some really good things to take away. I want to ask, because you used the word communication a lot earlier, and you do something a little bit unique. We talked about during COVID, you wanted to keep that alignment, which was much harder when you're not in an office 5 days a week, like was, you know, the case earlier than 2020. So you were communicating with a 1,000 person team when everyone went remote. Tell me about what you did to kind of keep that line of communication open for such a big team.
The first thing I did, so we all lived through COVID, so I don't have to explain it to anybody, right? And we all dealt with it in our own ways, I felt lonely, and I figured a lot of people also felt maybe a little scared and lonely. And I was trying to think of ways to connect. So the first thing I did, being old fashioned, is I asked my assistant to print out a list of everyone's all 1,000 emails, names and emails. And every morning when I'd wake up, my goal was to send 15 to 20 emails out personally, right? And I would just use a highlighter and mark those people off the list. I don't think I ever got through the entire 1,000, to be honest. And I would say, hey, just check in. I think the subject line was checking in, right? How you doing? What's going on? Love to chat. Appreciate you. Hope everything's well, you know, work, family, et cetera. Half the people thought it was spam and didn't respond, because they think, what are the odds that Iris sent me a personal note? He's never talked to me before. I'm in Norway. I barely speak English, right? But once people realized what I was doing, and they realized it was really me, I started getting lengthy responses. Like, some of them were maybe too lengthy. I heard the whole story about their entire family and who moved here. But I also solicited, you know, requests for, you know, you have any great ideas? Are there things that we're asking you to do that don't make sense to you, and things like that? So that's where it started. I think people appreciated that. Then I decided to be like you, and I started my own in-house podcast, if you will. Every Wednesday morning at 9:30, any one of those people was able to dial in, and it was just a way to connect. And I would give an update of what's going on. Some of my team members would update folks in terms of what was going on in those areas. We'd celebrate birthdays. And then I figured maybe people are going to start getting bored listening to Ira every week, every single Wednesday of the year. So I started, like you, bringing on guests. And I guess during COVID, maybe people had some extra time. So I had, you know, the CFO of Bank of America, the CFO of Marriott, the CEO of Raymond James, the CFO of PayPal, who's now the CFO of Walmart, great guy. And, you know, the list goes on. So I kind of made it a little more interesting that way. CFO of the NFL, who I worked with in that first audit job. As we came back to life and COVID kind of started drifting away, I've never given that up. So I still do it. And I try not to miss it. And somewhere between 400 and 550 of those people dial in every week. I'm sure there are some people, I probably know a few that have never dialed in, which pisses me off, but 400 to 550 people dial in every week. If I'm on the road, I'll do it from a hotel room. I've done it from an airport lounge. Once in a while, it's inevitable that I have to cancel it. I do a separate one each quarter after our earnings call as a public company to kind of give them the internal take on the previous quarter that we just announced. And that became so popular that our general counsel and chief information officer came to me and said, can my guys dial in? So now I have, and HR wanted to dial in. So now, you know, there's like 1500 people that dial in for those calls. It's a great way to keep in touch with people all over the world. Sometimes today's Thursday, I had, you know, my guy in Oslo, Norway, talking about what he has going on, including his ski trip over Christmas, but also, you know, work-related activity. We have a guy that when the war broke out in Ukraine that worked in my organization that is a young, nice guy living in Moscow who's now scared shitless of what to do with himself. So we were talking to him when the war was just breaking out. What are you going to do? We moved him to Dubai, and thank God, you know, he's doing well and never had to, you know, sign up for the military or anything like that. You know, so we've had all sorts of opportunities. And then I motivate the team to make recommendations on where we could make contributions. And then we would choose one every month. And then that the person who recommended the contribution would, you know, get on the call and talk about what it means to them. In many cases, it was personal. And we would make a contribution in their honor. So we still do that. So it's been a cool experience. And one of my IT guys wrote to me a few weeks ago and said, I think you should turn this into a podcast and open it up to the public. I go, I don't know if I'm ready for that, but maybe.
Are we announcing a new podcast? I mean, you already came here and flexed your guests on me. I'm not getting the CEOs and CFOs of those companies. My goodness.
Well, you know, I could work with you.
Well, let's figure out. Maybe there's a partnership opportunity.
Maybe I shouldn't tell you this, but I don't know if you watch CNBC. There's a guy named Dan Niles that's on almost every day. He's the guy that's kind of predicted major market moves in the past. He's now kind of predicting some softness this year. He said his number one investment idea this year is cash. He's going to be on one of my upcoming internal calls as well.
I love that. I don't need any more.
Maybe we should merge. You know, could be the eyes.
I love this idea. We can talk talent. We can talk leadership. Yeah. We can talk about all the things I'm passionate about. I love it. So I just, wow, amazing. I think one of the things that's the biggest takeaway for me there, outside of it being so exceptional and so unusual for a CFO of a large publicly traded company, is that in this age of technology and where we're going, right, this ability to build these human connections and do the things that others will not is really a way to stand out. I'll give you an example. I have a contact executive VP at a large Fortune 500 company as well in the technology space. He made a relationship pretty early on in his career with the person that provisions the emails for new people that join the company. And so what he asked them to do was, hey, send me those emails when they start. And then he writes a note to every level of person that starts in that company, right? And like people are like blown away, like this VP of technology is like, I don't work in technology, I'm an analyst or whatever it may be, right, is getting this personal touch. And it's such a small thing, but such an important thing. And I think it's important that even in this age of automation and AI, don't lean on the automation and AI to build a real human connection, which is something that's really central.
People don't realize, you nailed it, how everyone wants to get a bonus. Everyone wants to get a merit, you know, cost of living increase, right? Everyone wants a nice salary. People underestimate how meaningful that could be to the average employee that just comes in, does their job every day, probably thinks that no one even knows what their name is or what they look like. And then all of a sudden, whether it's the CEO or the CFO or someone else sends them a personal note and thanks them, people do not realize how ridiculously meaningful that is to almost everybody. Wow. I sent out, you know, I always, I like to write as well as talk, right? So I always take the time, like for New Year's, I sent the whole global team a New Year's note. And my assistant said, I'll send it out. She said, I'll send it out from my email address so you don't get inundated with out of office automated emails, right? I said, no, I want it from my address because I want people to have the opportunity to respond. So I did get, 600 out of office emails all in 1 minute. Took me 15 minutes to delete those, but dozens of people wrote back. And that's, what I was hoping for, to hear from some people that I don't talk to every day. So that stuff's, really important. And I try to, stress that as much
no,
as I can.
No surprise that you're at the level you're at doing the things that you do, man. I do want to take it a little bit more on a personal level, because there's something I want to talk about. We talked about when we first met back in early October, you mentioned you had one of the best weekends of your life. You were attending an event at the New World Symphony in Miami, an organization that you happen to sit on the board for. Can you tell us about the weekend? Tell us about the event.
So, sure. Someone came up with an idea about a year ago with the knowledge that the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II was coming up, this year into next year. They had this idea of having a series of concerts to commemorate the end of World War II. And the reason this person, who's the guy that runs that organization, took me to lunch is said, well, there's one that we think you're going to be exceptionally interested in, which is going to feature a piece called From the Diary of Anne Frank. And we're going to do that piece for one of the concerts that's going to commemorate the end of the Holocaust. The reason he knew that would be meaningful to me is because my mother survived Auschwitz. She was a member of a family of seven. Five of them perished. My mom passed away exactly 6 years ago last weekend. Her one brother that survived with her is actually 95 and still alive and living in Canada. So I immediately said, I don't know what you're asking me, but the answer is yes. So I agreed to chair this concert. And at the time that I agreed to it, A, I didn't know exactly when it was going to be, and I didn't know that much about it. I just knew it was going to feature this piece and it was going to commemorate the Holocaust, right? And I was obviously doing it for my mom. So I went on a letter writing campaign to everybody I know that I do business with or that has any money and said, of course, when you get the chair role, you're expected to raise, a boatload of money. They drafted something for me. It was more like, the symphony is a great place, which it is, right? And we do all these things for the community. I said, nah, I threw that out. I said, the only way, because it's hard to get money out of like the corporate world today. I'm making this personal. This is about my mom. And I went on a limb to say, this concert is going to be in honor of my mom, more formally than maybe they had anticipated. It worked, right? Because a lot of people said, it's really tough to go to my committee to get cash. But when I told them the story of you and your mom, money was pouring in. As the thing got closer, it turned out that this was now going to become the opening night concert of the season in October. And the piece was going to be narrated, because this piece, when it was first done, was actually narrated at Carnegie Hall. I think it was Carnegie Hall, by Katharine Hepburn. She collaborated in creating this piece many years ago. And it won a Grammy Award at one point. So all of a sudden, the 11th hour, they say, we got some interesting news for you. This piece is going to be narrated by Daisy Ridley, who is in Star Wars, is a famous actress from the UK. Still don't know how they pulled that off. And then they started preparing all the marketing materials and stuff and go, where's my mother, right? Because this is why I'm doing it, right? And push came to shove. They went above and beyond. So when the concert started that night, there was a pre-recorded, video image of me on the big screen and talking about my mother. And then the playbills had an insert. If anyone wants to go on the New World Symphony, I think it's nws.edu website, the link is still there with a whole story that they beautifully prepared by a professional writer.
We'll share it in the show notes for sure.
About my mother's story. And it was just an amazing, amazing night. And then there was a dinner afterwards, and I got to sit with Daisy Ridley, the actress, and her husband, Tom, who's also an actor. They were both in the remake of Murder in the Orient Express a few years ago. And I said to her, I said, I I got to speak before the concert started and you did a great job, something like that. And she's like, I know, Ira, I listened to every word you said. It was amazing. It was like the coolest thing to hear this from her. And then the whole dinner, she was just asking me questions about my mom. It was like, it was just an amazing, absolutely amazing experience. And the next day I went back because they did the concert one more time and brought my daughter, who wasn't there for the first night, so she could experience it. So it was an unbelievable way to honor, you know, my mom's now like all over the internet, where she probably, her name was, if you Googled her, nothing would have come up before except maybe her obituary. So it was, and a lot of people came up to me that night and said, you know, what a story. And I had a grandmother, or I had this, or I had that. And, you know, asked me a bunch of questions, and, some woman gave me a book about her family's life. Part of my life when I'm not working has always, been about honoring my mom because of the unique background. And I always tell people that, you know, my life's a miracle. I could go on forever about her because her survival was miraculous. She had, you know, way too many near-death experiences. If anyone goes on my Instagram page, most of my more permanent posts are pictures of my mother on the anniversary of her death or her birthday. That's about all you're going to see there. Right. That was, an absolutely phenomenal, and that's guided me to dovetail the other things we talked about. It's certainly impacted me professionally in many ways.
As a leader, like, what do you take away from your mom and her journey that you know is a big part of who you are as a leader?
You know, it's the resilience thing and not giving up and not worrying about screwing something up, knowing it could be a whole lot worse. In, you know, and it's not like reading it in the history book, you know. You know, mom went through something a whole lot worse. So if you like make a bad decision one day and take a chance and it doesn't go well, that's a whole lot better than watching your whole family get killed. You know, how that really transcends day to day, I'm not completely sure, but it certainly has an impact on the way you live your life, you know, the way you think, the way you treat others. You know, if you look at what's going on in the world today, you know, there's so many horrible things going on. People have different views on a lot of this stuff. But for me, it's even more difficult because my mom lived through it. Right. And it's kind of happening again in many ways, manifesting itself in different parts of the world. So she's kind of been this guiding light, and she lived till almost 95. So I got to spend,
wow, God bless,
an exceptional amount of time with her. There's something about mom every day, whether I'm at work or, you know, home over the weekend. So thanks for bringing that up.
No, I appreciate you sharing that, man. That is absolutely amazing. Resilient.
One quick thing. I'll try to make this one quick too. I have an Orthodox Jewish friend who had a son who got married on Sunday night in Coral Gables, even though he's from New York. I hadn't seen him for years, but I said, it's local. I told my wife, you've never been to one of these weddings. You're going to enjoy it. They're crazy, right? They're just bursting with energy. But the reason I bring the story up is the bride's, so, you know, I'm friends of the father of the groom. The bride's dad's name looked familiar and his face looked a little familiar. So I walked up to him during the wedding, shook his hand and congratulated him. And I asked him what he did. And the second he told me, I remembered who he was. He was a doctor. And when my mother was dying, he was the guy coming into her room every day, comforting her, comforting me. What a small world, right? So I got to like talk about my mom just on Sunday all over again. So that was very, that was wild. I mean, it almost brought me to tears that I gave him a big hug and everyone wondered, like, we don't know each other. Why are we hugging each other by the dance floor? So that was a pretty cool moment just this past Sunday.
Super inspirational, man. Hopefully when this pod comes out, we can get another bump for it. We'll definitely link to your Instagram as well. I really appreciate you sharing, Ira.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
All right, Ira, I really appreciate all the stories and insights so far as a leader. I want to talk about hiring because that's a big part of what we do here and something I'm obsessed with. So I want to start here. If you had to think about a core hiring philosophy, you've hired thousands of people, it sounds like, throughout your career. Do you have one that comes to mind when you think about what you're looking for out of people that you want to bring into your organization, your team?
Yeah, you know, one thing I could say, I can answer that many different ways, but one thing that impacted me a bit was being handed this easy to read book several years ago called The Ideal Team Player by a guy named Patrick Lencioni.
Great author.
And his storyline told in a very simple way, using a very example of a very simple company, I think it was like a plumbing business, talks about your best employees being humble, hungry, and smart. Mm-hmm. Humble and hungry are self-explanatory. Smart may not be what you would immediately assume when you just hear the word, because it's more about street smarts and having influential skills and knowing how to handle yourself, emotional intelligence and things like that, asking good questions, being a good listener. When you read that book, what's funny, maybe funny isn't the right word, is, and it kind of tells you to suggest that you do this, you immediately start going through your staff and people that you've interviewed and people, and you start classifying them. And what the book says is very few people nail all three, right? You should hope that everyone you have working for you is nailing at least two out of the three. And if they're only at one, there's one of two solutions. You believe that you could actually improve where they're weak, or they should be counseled out of the organization. I handed that book to every one of my hiring managers and made them read it. And we've kind of used that as a guiding principle when we're interviewing people. Now, interviews aren't that easy because you only get like a 45-minute snapshot. I've used some creative ways of figuring stuff. So it's, you know, there's no perfect recommendation to someone on how to nail an interview as the interviewer. But you certainly could be, you know, with those guiding principles, I'm always asking questions or just having a conversation with someone to get a feel for how I feel that they may fit into those categories. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's worked pretty well. I may also, one of the funny stories I like telling is I may, before I make my final decision, do something as simple as taking someone out to lunch. My funny story that I told a few times is about to hire this guy. And embarrassingly, I did hire this guy even after telling you the story. And he didn't work out. I asked the waitress in the restaurant for an iced tea, and she said they didn't have any. She turns to the candidate and said, "What would you like to drink?" And he asked for an iced tea. So I immediately said to myself, this guy wasn't paying attention, right? And is he going to be paying attention? And will he have attention to detail at his job? That wound up being the thing that he was weakest at. It would have been a weird thing to go to HR and say, I decided not to hire this guy because he didn't hear that I ordered an iced tea. So sometimes it's little things. I've made decisions in the last second to pull an offer just based on, in some cases, the way the candidate was negotiating their package, right? So, I used the term earlier, it's more of an art than a science, but I do look for, humble, right? Having people with massive egos just doesn't work. When you get back to your question earlier about alignment, those are the people that generally are hard to get aligned, right?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I was going to ask about a memorable interview experience and you gave a great one. I'm actually somebody that believes that hiring should be more of a science than an art. And that's what my life's work is in terms of the software we're building. But from this perspective, our gut, our intuition comes from a place of previous experience. You can codify that. So, you know, I don't think it would have been out of hand to say, you know what, this isn't the right fit for us because we're guessing this person's in a financial role. Attention to detail is really important. And they're somewhere else. And you probably rationalized that at the time as you made the offer, but then it ultimately proved out to be the case. When we have such little information as we do in an interview, and especially when somebody is being, you would think, their best self or the best version of their self, you have to look at those little things and extrapolate them to a degree, particularly with what's important to the job. Now, maybe if you were hiring a creative director, and they didn't hear that. And it's because they're thinking of the next great creative thing they want to build in the interview. Maybe that's not as big a deal, but certainly for that role, that stands out. So I'm with you on that. I line on that 100%. Do you have a favorite like question that you like to ask? Because it sounds like you do some pretty deep insights in terms of when you're reflecting on the interviews. Is there a question you like to ask that you think is either provocative or really gets a great answer from candidates?
I mean, I have so many. I mean, I enjoy asking questions about people and their life outside of work. Mm. That one always is interesting. Gives me a feel for what the person's really, as opposed to coming in prepared with all the canned answers. To the paperboy experience, I like asking people where they start out. What was your first job? Did you work, you know, in high school or college? What was that experience like? This sounds weird, Oz, but my favorite question is asking the candidate what questions they have for me. And
100%. And when they say they don't have one, that's a red flag, right?
More than 50% of the candidates say, I said, you know, after I'm kind of all done, I say, you know, I want to give time for you to ask me any questions, something we may not have covered. More than 50% of candidates say, I think you covered everything. And that's like so lame if you think about
Let me tell you why it's lame. And I don't think people understand this when they don't have a question. See, if you're inquisitive and you're curious, it's impossible for somebody to be comprehensive because the more they say, the more things that should pop up in your head as potential questions are things that you want to better understand. And so I think people get nervous or they're not prepared. But if you're actively listening, that should lead to more questions. So like I agree with you.
There's the overuse of that. And some people come too prepared and then they have like 50 questions. That's not good either.
Too much.
Right. They have to have, and then some of them, you know, they're just asking questions for the sake of asking. So that's also, that part of the interview is also telling. So I'm like 3/4 of the way through the interview. I get to that. I'm either on the fence or I'm not. If I'm on the fence, that often throws me the wrong way. Yeah. If that just falls flat. Right.
I've had some situations where the questions people ask me were the reason that I ended up hiring. Like I liked them. And then they asked some really insightful questions that you could tell were not, you know, prepared or boilerplate coming in, that they were really thinking about the opportunity in the right way. And again, I love people that are self-aware. So that's one thing. If you ask too many questions or no questions, that you might lack that skill. But I love people that are curious. And I want to, it's okay if they're asking what's in it for them, because I also look at the interview as much as I'm interviewing you, you're interviewing me, and this needs to make sense for you. Otherwise, this isn't going to work out. So I think that's really, really good.
For a more senior person, I often use this one and say, okay, I hired you. A year has gone by. Tell me what happened. What'd you do? What worked out well? What didn't work out well? That's a tough one to answer. But someone really solid that's got a strategic mindset. So I won't ask that to like, you know, an accounts payable clerk, right? But if it's a more senior, you know, manager level position, it's kind of cool to, you know, because some people say, what are you going to do in your first 30 days? So I throw the whole year at them and say, you know, A, what was the outcome after the first year and how'd you get there?
I love that. I ask a variation of that with a little twist. When my team is interviewing somebody that's coming into our organization, I ask them, let's say a year from now, this person didn't work out. Why would that have been? And it's interesting to hear them either dive into what they think are like the red flags they had or the issues they had, or their own ability to set this person up for success or things going on in our organization that maybe I need to think about to make sure that we can empower people to have their best chance to be successful. So I love that question. I love you getting them thinking out a little bit like that. I challenge my hiring leaders around that in terms of, tell me why this person wouldn't work out. Because everybody wants to, if they love somebody, they're going to tell you all the reasons.
To that point where what I still haven't perfected is there are way too many times, and I don't have enough time, but I try to get at least, you know, if it's a mid-level manager or up, get on the interview slate for even 15 minutes. Because what happens way too often is the hiring manager is like, oh my God, this position's been open for 3 months. I'm struggling. This person came in. They have two arms and two legs, a little bit of hair, and they're breathing, right? I'm going to hire them.
Yeah.
And then I see them for 15 minutes, and I said, this is the person you want to hire, and I nix it. And people hate that, and that's why they try to avoid me even getting on the slate. And I understand where they're coming from. I said, but you know, once you hire this person, you're going to invest a lot of time. And I know it sucks for the position to be open, but then you're going to be doing it all over again in 6 months.
It's such a short-term mindset because it's like, and I get it. Like you said, like, hey, God, I got to get this headcount filled, or maybe it goes away, or I'm like stretching my team out, or I'm stretching myself out. And you're right. It's a common bias that comes up, but you have to avoid it because the problem is when you hire somebody and you bring them in, it becomes a one-year problem, two-year problem, three-year problem, rather than another month of the position being open. So I think you're spot on.
I won't elaborate on this one too much, but I could give you the high level. To take that to the nth degree, I'm actually on the board of another public company. You know, we haven't talked about that. Without getting, you know, too granular, going through a CEO transition, right? And I got to meet, you know, a couple of the candidates and I was on the interview panel. The line of questioning, even at that level, at the board level, was which one? You interviewed both. And my answer was neither. That wasn't one of the choices I was given, but that was the answer I provided.
Wow, love that.
And what I can tell you is that wound up being the case. It's wound up being neither. And we kept going. Right. So
which one is a false choice? I love that you said that.
Yeah. Yeah. So whether it's board level or junior, you know, we probably don't do enough training in that regard. You know, you mentioned alignment. By the way, the other thing that happens, you know, my mind keeps spinning as you ask these questions. I remember one guy who I really liked. So I was on the interview panel. I really liked the guy. The guy wound up turning down the offer. So I followed up with him. What did the guy say to me? He said, and this was one of the reasons I like this guy, because he was inquisitive and he asked the right questions. He said, well, I interviewed with four different people and I asked them what my priorities would be in the first 3 or 6 months. And he said, Ira, I got four completely different answers. So how can I take this job? Because you guys aren't aligned. You're all over the place.
Well, as soon as you started talking alignment, I thought of interviewing. And so we built software in Aon where we've made over 15,000 hires as a company at MSH. And looked at all the reasons why a hire goes wrong. Lack of alignment on the team is a huge one. Not having the same definition of success, of what it looks like. Not truly understanding the requirements for success on a position. And then obviously asking questions that get you to that place. Not being comprehensive. I mean, I've seen so many situations where people hired somebody in executive level positions. And then a month in, they're like, oh, did we ask about this? Or did we know how they deal with terse stakeholders? Or did we know the commute was going to be such an issue for them? Like, there are so many ways that we get this wrong, and lack of alignment is one of the biggest. And also,
people throw a bunch of people together on an interview panel, and just because they feel like that's the right thing to do, those people don't even get together and discuss. So in many cases, someone's on that list and they don't even understand the job.
It's like doing a play or synchronized swimming and everybody just shows up and then they all do their own thing.
That's right. So it's
a great call out. Last thing I want to ask you on the hiring side before we jump into the last bit. Is there anything about the hiring process, the way it exists today, whether it be within your own company or maybe when you were interviewing, that's like super frustrating or something that you wish I could snap my fingers and would be fixed?
Well, a lot of what we talked about, B, it takes too long. So I'm always hungry. I say, okay, I know we need this position. I go to HR and then 4 weeks later I show up and they said, we don't want to throw weak candidates in front of you, so we're doing work. I said, that's BS. You know, so speed, especially when it's a key position, is speed and focus is something that is really important to me that we still don't excel at. And the other thing is, you know, you'll take the time to write a job spec, which is a science to do well. And then candidates will show up that don't even meet the spec. It's like, okay, well, why do you even bring that? Well, but, you know, they have this instead. I go, well, that's, you know, I had a CEO that I worked for many years ago, and he had this stupid line, which was actually wound up being somewhat profound. It was a must is a must is a must. So he goes, when you prepare that job spec, you have some things that are nice to have, but it's going to have some things that are musts. And I don't care if the person's God, if they don't have one of those musts that you decided was something you must have, they're out.
They're absolute deal breakers. You have to know what the deal breakers are, the must have versus the want to have, right?
But very few people follow that religiously because, again, the natural tendency is I need to hire someone. Well, they got 2 out of 3. So you're not going to come up with 50 musts, by the way. I know they don't have the third one, but I'm going to give him a chance. Well, then you screwed up from the get-go, right? So, you know, it's things like that. It's, you know, it is not easy. You do need, you know, you're on the outside looking in. HR is a way more critical organization than most people realize, because those guys can make a huge difference if they do all this stuff.
The thing we have to understand is the people that we bring into our organization, how we retain them and how we develop them is a bottom line impact. And that's why I talk with a lot of CFOs and CEOs of understanding what the cost of a role being extended a long time, making the wrong hire, attrition, retraining. Only starting to get our hands around that. And it's something that's really, really important. I will tell you this. If you go another 4 weeks and have any of those unqualified candidates, you give me a ring over here at MSH. We'll move a little bit faster for you.
I
want to ask you this last one, and I'm going to go on the speed round because I want to talk Yankees a little bit. Do you have any advice that you'd give your 20-year-old self that you didn't know then that you know now?
Wow. Sure. Don't trust everybody. Trust yourself more. You know, believe in yourself. Again, those stories I told you of, you know, freaking out first day of work. I think it's, you know, it's, you know, have more confidence in yourself. There was a great line. I think I wrote it down in preparing for this, but I don't know what I did with it. Maybe it's not.
I won't say you have lack of attention to detail. I'm not going to say that about you, Eric, because I know that's not the case.
No, I had another quote that I thought I may use, but it's not the right one for this discussion. I think it's just, you know, that's trust probably the biggest thing by far is trusting yourself, believing in yourself, which, you know, I guess I used to use the line, I've stopped using it a bit, that the reason I've been so successful is because I never had enough confidence in myself and I felt that I had to prove myself every day. I guess that's still kind of true, but I've kind of twisted that around more recently. I don't use that line anymore.
Isn't the inverse of that the hungry that you're talking about? Because if you're constantly thinking I need to be doing more and kind of paranoid about your ability to get your job done, that's a version of staying hungry, is it not?
It is, but it doesn't necessarily have to be overdosed with I don't think I could, I'm hungry to do it, but I don't believe I could do it. You want to be hungry to do it and believe you could do it and be confident that you're going to get there and not being worried about making the mistake goes back to my mom's story of things could be a lot worse. So making mistakes and that's one of my common interview questions too, and where you rarely get a cool answer, which is tell me about a failure and how you dealt with it. Too many people say, well, I've never failed. Like, F you. That's bullshit. Yeah. We've all
failed. And you haven't done enough. You haven't put yourself out there.
I failed yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. Self-belief is key, but thinking you've arrived or thinking you're an expert and you've got it all figured out is also very deadly. So,
yeah.
Okay. I want to ask you some quick Yankee questions here. So we're going to go lightning round.
Oh, boy.
Favorite Yankee of all time?
Ron Bloomberg.
Okay. I got to ask about why.
He was like a Jewish guy from Georgia who could only hit righties, but every time he was up, he hit a home run. And I got to meet him a couple times when I was a kid. And so the days I was going to games all the time, he wasn't around that long. But he was here. And one day I brought a sign saying I loved him to a doubleheader. And the next day in Newsday, the headline story of the Yankee win, said Yankees split the doubleheader, but Bloomberg happy. And he referred in his quote to my sign. So from that day, he became my favorite player.
Whoa.
And during COVID, my friend whose son had his wedding that I referred to earlier, all this stuff's connected, said, hey, I know you loved this guy, Bloomberg, when you were a kid. My friend does a podcast for sports and he's going to be his guest. So you may want to dial in during COVID. So I dialed in, and in the chat function, you know, they asked if anyone had any questions. They said, tell this guy that I'm the guy that was the kid that held up the sign and the big doubleheader that he had where he hit like four home runs. And he wound up engaging with me on the podcast. This was just a couple years ago.
That's amazing.
And I now have an autographed bat. And he's in the Hall of Fame because he's the first designated hitter to ever get a base hit. And the interesting story there is in the first year of the designated hitter, someone else was supposed to be coming to bat before him in another game, but I think it was a rain delay, right? So he wound up being the first designated hitter to ever bat, and he actually got a hit. So he also has got hits. He's in the Hall of Fame for that. You know, aside from that, there are so many that are close. I would say Paul O'Neill was probably another.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, most people would have said the Yankee Clipper or Mantle or Jeter.
Yeah, well, those were before my time, right? So I'm thinking of, you know, obviously Mariano Rivera, you know, legend.
But what's your favorite championship? Which one stands out the most to you?
The one that I missed when Wade Boggs was riding around on a horse, because my cousin, who I'm going to see this weekend, was getting married in Montreal. So I had a miss. So that was in the Yankees beat the Braves, and it was two games. Was it 2-2? I'm trying to remember. And I knew I was going to miss the game that they had a chance to win the World Series in New York. So I actually pissed off my wife a little bit, flew to Atlanta to go to the game before the weekend when the wedding was going to be in Canada. And that's the game. It was an amazing game. So that put the Yankees up 3-2. Paul O'Neill was in right field, and the Yankees were winning 1-0. And in the ninth inning, I think there were one or two guys on for the Braves, bottom of the ninth. I was sitting out in right field. Some guy hits a long drive, and I have the picture on my wall. I'm looking at it right now if I turn my camera around. Paul O'Neill reaches out. I couldn't see from my seat for a moment that he actually caught the ball. If he missed it, they lost the game. And he caught it, game over, Yankees up 3-2, and they went to New York and won the famous Game 6 with Wade Boggs, which I had a hard time watching because I was in Montreal, and like every TV screen and bars near where the wedding venue was showing hockey preseason games.
Worth it. That was the inverse of the Goodwill Hunting story.
Yeah.
Of Carlton Fisk.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then I got to go the first year in the new Yankee Stadium when they beat the Phillies. That was pretty cool. That was Hideki Matsui's like 7 RBI game, last game he ever played for the Yankees.
I remember what George Steinbrenner called him too. Okay, so who's the more annoying little brother, Mets or Red Sox?
Mets are the more annoying little brother. Red Sox is just, you know, absolute hatred.
Hatred. And so did you hate their championships as much as you loved yours?
Well, the worst day in my life, literally, aside from my parents dying, was when the Yankees blew their 3-0 lead in the World Series to the Red Sox.
I know.
I'll never, ever forget that. As a matter of fact, if I turn my screen to the side, those are my two Yankee stadium chairs.
Well, and that's going to lead to my last question, because here's the thing. I am a big baseball buff. I never got to go to Yankee Stadium. I never got to go to Monument Valley. I did go to this monstrosity of a corporate stadium here. What's your feelings on the new Yankee Stadium versus the old Yankee Stadium?
Look, the old Yankee Stadium had this charm. I had a lot of amazing moments, some of the best Yankee teams that I experienced ever played there. And not that long after the new Yankee Stadium, I moved to Florida, right? So I had limited experience in the new stadium. That first year was great, right? But most of my memories are old stadium. So it was really sad for me when they tore that down. The new stadium's cool. It's probably one of the cooler baseball stadiums out there with a lot of history. But I've never had an attachment to it because, you know, shortly after it was built, I was out of there. And I don't go back that much. I used to have like partial year season tickets in the old stadium. Went there when I was a kid, you know, some amazing, you know, Cal Ripken's last game in New York, you know, a lot of cool moments in the old stadium. Maybe I got to go back there now this season.
I love that. Hey, I'd love to go to a game with you. Listen, Ira, I appreciate you coming on. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Good luck
to your Yankees this upcoming season. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
Take care.
Talk to you.
Yeah. All right. Bye-bye.